Okay, this is November 28th. We're in Donald Percy's office here in the Jackson Clinic. And my name is Martin Dowling, and we want to talk for a while about the story of the merger of the University of Wisconsin and the development of the University of Wisconsin system. I figured just to start, we'd sort of set the stage and get a little background. 1966, you were appointed assistant vice president.
Yes, at the former University of Wisconsin. Right. Yes.
And then in 70, you were a full vice president.
Yes.
That was, and that in the same year, 66, we there became a sort of a powered up, bolstered CCHE.
Yeah, Coordinated Council for Higher Education. There was an effort to strengthen it and continue it. There mm-hmm. were efforts at the same time to eliminate it as not being effective.
I just wanted to ask, first off, in general, that did you see now or didn't, or can you remember your perspective then of any sort of trends happening in the state, in Madison, that sort of would lead to the reevaluation of state higher education, which occurred then in the late 60s and early 70s?
Particularly in the early 70s, but there had been an uncertainty at the national level of what kind of role the federal government, with all the money it was pumping into education, ought to insist on playing itself or insist at the state level be played out. Mm-hmm. There was a movement to establish something called post-secondary education commission, and this was an effort to entice states to bring under one bureaucratic roof the coordination of all higher education, public and private, in the states. And this idea was surfaced. I can't remember the time. It may have well been down the pike a bit, but it was surfaced. And at the state level, entities like the Higher Education Aids Board, which had a very narrow focus, but considered itself non-denominational as regards to higher education.
Is that a state?
It's a state board that administered student aids. That's mm-hmm. all it did. But it happened to administer aids for both public and private higher education. And there was interest among its leader, its chief executive, and perhaps some of its board members that perhaps they ought to aspire to the post-secondary education commission role. It was called PSEC, and this idea never quite came to fruition. But it was representative of the kind of question you seem to be asking, mm-hmm. and the answer to the question. There was a feeling, even at the national level, that there had to be better coordination of higher education, that there was a need to coordinate it for a vast majority or variety of purposes. But various states had done it different ways. Here in Wisconsin, they'd gone to the Coordinating Committee for Higher Education, or Coordinating Council, it was then changed mm-hmm. to. And if you want me, I can spend a few moments on why that device was not equal to the task, which
sure,
is really the background for merger.
Mm-hmm.
In its earliest incarnation, it was staffed by people drawn from the university systems, the state university system, the UW system, and it always seemed necessary to have it headed by someone not coming from either of those systems, so they would typically pick someone to head it from either public education, a former state superintendent of public instruction, Angus Rothwell, or from out of state in the education setting, either higher education or a teacher of education, so that in its first incarnation as the Coordinating Committee for Higher Education, the bill that went through establishing it had all sorts of responsibilities. It had a relatively small staff. Its responsibilities far outdistanced its capabilities, mm-hmm. and its strength politically and realistically up against two tried and true university systems, including the Voc-Tech system, I should add.
I'm talking about
first CCHE.
Right, before 66.
And I will get to after 66.
Okay.
But Typically, this was a discussion board, a necessary preliminary bout before you really went down and argued with the governor and thence with the Joint Finance Committee. There was a feeling, and I'm sure there was a study and a legislative review that said it's not working because it's not strong enough. And this was during the Knowles administration, and a number of Governor Knowles appointees were on there, one of whom was Bill Krause, I recall. Former Governor Kohler was chairperson. And there was an effort made in 66 to strengthen it, to give it even stronger authority, incidentally not with enough resources added to carry out that authority. Indeed, the seed of the demise of CCHE was that its reach, its expected reach, outdistanced its real grasp.
Even from the beginning.
Even from the beginning, and especially at the end. And I remember vividly their attempts to control the growth of new academic programs. Extensive paperwork and debate, or to take on an issue about do we need a veterinary medicine college. Whole series of issues that were, quite frankly, no-win issues because it was just a preliminary bout. Because if it had any budgetary or policy implications, the real arena was the gubernatorial one and the legislative one. So what happened was that along about the time that the first or perhaps the second superintendent, I think Bill Call was involved as well, perhaps as a member, and may have served as chair for a while or head of it, I was approached. I was on the staff of the University of Wisconsin and the president's staff. I think I was an assistant vice president at the time, may have been vice president. I was approached by members of that board inquiring as to my interest in serving as the new executive director of the CCHE. And I met with their screening committee and indeed was selected by that committee. I had indicated that committee that the only way the CCHE could function effectively was to pick four or five things it would do and do well and eliminate the 15 or 16 others that simply couldn't be brokered with that size staff. And I think at that time I wanted freedom to choose my own staff members. I mean, you're talking about a very modest number of people, I think less than 12.
Yeah.
And the reaction to all that was swift. The search committee for the CCHE, which was board members, council members, were primarily gubernatorial appointees of Governor Knowles, Republicans. And there was a strong reaction in the legislature among Republicans who felt that my identification with the university was enough to rule me out. I don't ever recall being accused of not being having the competence to, or the lack of wisdom
it was just an extension of that idea that
that I mentioned earlier, namely that you really can't take one from either track, either the state university track or the UW track, and put them in charge. This theme will play its way out as we talk about merger later, but in any case, to make a long story short, John Shabazz was assembly majority leader, because the Republicans were in the majority of the assembly, and Walter Hollander was the senator, co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, and between the two of them, they made it clear that if I were appointed to that post, there would be no budget for the CCHE the next time around. It was pretty blunt. And the great phrase at that time that John Shabazz has been known for is we don't want the fox watching the chickens.
Right, yeah.
And a marvelous phrase. And in any case, I withdrew. I had the wisdom to do that. They proceeded to hire Art Brown, who was from out of state, educator, and he took over responsibility for CCHE. He brought, or already there was either Bill White from the state university system, an academic affairs person. I don't recall, there may have been one or two persons there in facilities from the UW system, but it was pretty balanced. And it was Brown and White were the key figures in it. And the CCHE chugged along. The same inherent problem was there. You would go through hearings on the budget there, you would go through hearings on academic program review. They had the final authority there, but they did not have final authority in the budget. They would recommend a budget to the governor for all of post-secondary education, public post-secondary. UW, WSU and Voc-Tech. Now, Voc-Tech was always kind of riding along there and really never came under the same scrutiny as the UW. I mean, it was never envisioned that the Voc-Tech system would in any way duplicate anything, you know. In point of fact, the greatest concern was the duplication between Voc-Tech and the university extension programs, both state and UW. So the revitalized, rejuvenated, and strengthened CCHE met an early demise when the members of that council, such as Bill Krause, simply concluded it was no longer an effective mechanism. It would appear before the legislature's Joint Finance Committee and make a budget presentation. It was clearly, the reporters wouldn't even stay for it because they knew in the hour and a half that took, they were just waiting to get at President Harrington and Gene McPhee from the UW and the State University, who were sitting there in the room waiting. And it was sad in many ways because they did an effective job of presenting what they had done. But it was not given the kind of respect.
It wasn't something that worked itself out in those hearings. It was just a foregone.
It was a foregone conclusion that the main show began after the CCHE and its slides got out of the way. Mm. And they would invariably have to make a presentation in the Joint Finance Committee room, which was, at that time was horrible for presentations of an audiovisual sort. Mm. Many's the time I sat there and watched them just literally die. I mean, they would turn the lights back on and 3/4 of the committee members were gone, you know, and there were people on the staff, I should really mention parenthetically, who, when they thought I was coming, felt threatened by that, feeling that I would not retain them, and they worked rather effectively, too, in the legislature. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember any names there?
No, I remember some names, but I don't think it's useful.
Yeah.
I can understand their anxieties, and they were down pleading for, in effect, their own jobs, which did not sit well with the legislators for the most part, except as it fed the fox watching the chickens kind of mentality. In any case, it failed because its board members lost, the council members themselves, the gubernatorial appointees and the designated appointees, some people were there by virtue of their office, the ex officios, simply lost faith that it could really accomplish the things it had been charged to accomplish. And it just simply began to fade. Mm. And which is, when you understand that, you begin to understand about the ground being prepared for the seat of merger, which is played out later.
Well, was there any way to save CCHE? I mean, was there any way to bolster their faith or give them?
I made a proposal that, and I made it publicly, matter of fact, that if the CCHE would focus on 4 to 5 areas and do it effectively, control primarily through budget processes and the building programs, you had a state building commission that could review those. We could make a recommendation to them as a CCHE as far as the academic need, therefore, but the CCHE tried to become everything that already existed and wasn't working, you know, and they just became another entity that wasn't working. And some people said it was a good way it was a dilatory action to stretch out, you know, stronger executive controls. And every governor that's come along that had been there in the past didn't quite know how to handle these two marvelous entities out there. The third entity, BTAE system, took care of itself. It was highly respected for the state. Its students were not raucous and rowdy. They were not from out of state. They did not cause problems. They didn't have a football team, but I mean, other than that, I think that it's important to know that the VTAE was there all along and would do very well in all these processes. After all, they trained people, when it came down to it, they trained people for real jobs.
Right.
You know, and that was often said. And It was hard to find a strong legion of support in the legislature or among the governor's staff. There was always, and perhaps the university and the state university's most difficult people to deal with were their own products, the people who had been there. And we will get later to the name of David Adamandy, and you will see what I mean about dealing with your own products.
Well, I've seen the point made that in general this kind of organization in any state suffers from a lack of a political base. It doesn't have a football team.
That is probably completely overlooked. It does not have a constituency.
Yeah.
That was good that you mentioned that because I remember now from studying coordinating attempts all over that it was the lack of a constituency that in the final political instance, you know, was the death knell of them. And there were CCHEs out in California. There were post-secondary education commissions in California. All of those failed for the same reason. No constituency. Either way, the legislature didn't consider it its entity. The governor certainly didn't consider it his entity. And the institution, certainly. And the citizens didn't rise up. There were no homecomings for the CCHEs, you know.
Well, before we get to merger, I wanted to talk a little bit about Harrington's administration. I wonder if you had any thoughts on Harrington's efforts at changing higher education in Wisconsin and attaching Madison to new universities in Green Bay, Parkside, and whether that had an effect on later developments and what they were.
Let's do a little history since that's what we're talking about.
Okay.
Fred Harrington had been selected as president of the University of Hawaii and was going there to take that post, and it in fact worked with people there assuming that post when Conrad Elvium died. And Fred was called back to be president of his university, and it was an opportunity he couldn't resist, and he built some bridges in Hawaii, brought a person or two back from there with him. Charles Engman was one. I think all along, Fred wanted to be president of a university. He had it in his bones. He was a skillful person. And he jumped at the chance to be president of his own university. And it was fascinating. He built his administration. He built a central administration. Had a number of special assistants, and they would become important as you go along. And my recollections of that, I came in after the patterns and the traditions had been pretty well established. There was typically a cabinet meeting on Monday morning, and it would more often be monological, because Fred was so smart and so bright, even when he was listening to you, he knew what you were going to say, and he already had figured out what the answer to the question was. But he was... he practiced civility, and he would listen carefully. But you always had the sense that he knew where he was going, and he had a plan. He had around him a number of assistants, all of whom appeared later on in the higher education scene in this state or elsewhere as a vice president, as a chancellor, as a coordinator of higher education in California, as the head of university extension. These were people like Don McNeil, George Field. Don McNeil went on to be head of Chancellor of Extension, the first chancellor of the merged extension in UW. He then went on to head up the Post-Secondary Education Commission in California. George Field went on to become president of River Falls, WSU River Falls, eventually UW River Falls. Charles Engman was vice president for administration, I think the title was. He eventually went into the Institute for Advanced Study. Trying to think, Bob Taylor handled his public affairs, eventually became vice president for public affairs in the new merged system.
So your point here is that they benefited from that.
Absolutely. Everyone associated with Fred, who gave him loyalty and who saw him operate and learn from that, they were recognized for all of those features and were the people he could put in these jobs, and therefore have the kind of control one needs to have. And this is important because he reached the conclusion that there were going to be new campuses and worked very hard, got himself positioned on the committee to develop new campuses, got right in the middle of the battle over would it be Racine or Kenosha, etc. And right in the middle, he made a judgment that those institutions ought to be part of the UW. Now the UW at that point, you know, they brought in UWM in the 50s, and that merger was never complete for 20 years, you know. And Joe Clocci was the chancellor, or the president, and then the chancellor there for the longest time, longest tenure ever, over 25 years. But UWM was always kind of in the city, but not quite of the city. and was tied into the Madison campus divisional executive committees initially for review of tenure, eventually broke away and found its own identity, its own, learned not to try to emulate the Madison campus, but, and this is one thing we were able to do, get it to build the peaks of excellence, three or four of them. UW-Milwaukee developed its own identity. Green Bay and Parkside, once they were in the family of the University of Wisconsin, presented a real, just the same challenge that we'd had with the two-year centers before in terms of quality of its programs, how to maintain that, Madison campus, paternalism in terms of, Extension had the same problem. Everything had to go through the Academic Center of Excellence in Madison, and it was a good quality control device, although both Fred and Bob Clodius, who was his academic vice president, and myself would get irritated at times that research almost got precedence over teaching, and we set out at one time, that's a whole other part of our life, to change that. But so what you had was a research and instructional campus doing the tenure and the hiring and tenure reviews of people that were primarily in two-year centers coming to four-year campuses at Green Bay and Parkside, which were formed out of two-year centers in those areas, and University Extension. So Fred made the judgment that it would be in the best interest of the University of Wisconsin to have a geographical base broader than Madison-Milwaukee's axis, all right? Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, it was a stroke of genius because during the uprisings in the 60s on the campuses in the 70s, there were years, and I worked on the university budget for many of those years, when the only way we got anything through the legislature for the Madison campus was by bringing along the votes of the people who were in the center system communities and in the Green Bay Parkside communities. Mm-hmm. I would give Fred A for vision on that, if that indeed was the plan. And he absolutely relished public appearances on budget things. He was a very tall man and a singular presence not only for his academic stature but his personal stature, and he had this booming voice, you know, and had this marvelous way of no matter where you were, he was talking down to you, even when you were seated opposite him. And he would go down to the Joint Finance Committee, and after the CCHE preliminaries got over, Fred would move up. Gene McPhee from the State Universities would always go second because he wanted to. Because the university would go through, get their budget, and Gene would say, I'll take what they got. And literally, we used to get so frustrated. We'd be up there for budget hearing days on end. McPhee would come in and he'd be done in a day and a half and simply take whatever we took on faculty salaries, etc. That becomes an issue in our current time, you know, but it was just amazing.
So Harrington was successful in dealing with the legislature.
Oh, yeah, he was, well, no
I've heard,
one really
I've heard
liked,
other,
no
other
one
comments.
Really liked
yeah,
him.
Right.
He was, Fred was not a person you ever got close to personally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was almost by design, you know, and I'm sure he and his wife and their family, you know, were close person. But you never, I don't know of too many people that really knew Fred Harrington. A few of us knew of his great affection for cats, his absolute encyclopedic memory for baseball facts and things like that. But that still wasn't knowing Fred. Maybe he was a person not to be known. He was an awesome person in the legislature and made people, not by design, I don't think he was conscious, but you tended to feel small. And they were offended. He always had the answers. He always was on top and he always knew best. A lot of people probably didn't trust him. There was no great weeping when he left. You know, in the sense among legislators. There were always people, though, he had around him who could work with the legislature just fine and talk their language
right.
And, you know, drink the beer, play ping pong, do whatever one had to do to rally up the support for this or that issue. But personally, he was probably not well liked on the Hill.
Yeah. You made, when we talked last time I talked to you, you made the point that in his own office he had the policy of sort of playing different individuals off on each other. Could you explain that?
Playing off, let me put the best face on it.
Okay.
he enjoyed seeing people, his staff, compete against one another because he determined he got the best product from that result. To give two people the same assignment just to see who did the best job, he kind of enjoyed. He would do that with real skill. There are others that followed him in roles in the campus who did that quite well too, some consummately. But I don't remember that as a very strong feature. It was just an anecdotal observation of those mm-hmm. Of us that worked there.
Was there a strong reaction in Madison or around the campus here to his stance toward Green Bay and Parkside, sort of?
Oh, it wasn't strong.
His devotion to Madison may be a little suspect. I mean, granted that you say that it helped him in the
I don't capital. Think anyone ever questioned his Madison credentials. Yeah. They may have questioned the wisdom of Madison, which had already had difficulty assimilating extension and two-year centers, in reaching out still to four-year campuses. But most people simply respected his political judgment that it was wise to mm-hmm. do this. That it would be better for, quote, UW to control them than for the WSU to add two more campuses to its rather sizable and widely spread geographically political base. And he and Gene McPhee were friendly adversaries, both good in their own way at what they did.
So your job then under Harrington was?
Mm-hmm. I came in what? Under initially working as assistant vice president for the vice president of the university, who was Clodius,
right.
Which mainly in the academic affairs and research administration areas, and then kind of through the Peter Principal, moved into different things. Mm-hmm. But I would work on things like university rules and regulation, on divisional committee review of tenure, what ought to be the guidelines for extramural support applications, what about the academic staff? Do we really need 500 titles? Can't we get a more reasonable? Mm-hmm. I just was kind of a utility infielder handling a lot of things.
But yeah. Did you gradually sort of start to concentrate on budget work?
Yes. Yeah, eventually, and I didn't begin as a budgeteer. No. I did that largely through the acquiescence of Bob Clodius, mm-hmm. Who was vice president. I would pick up more and more of that role. And eventually you move to the center of the budget process along with the business vice president, who was Neil Cafferty at that time. But I would sort of handle the programmatic, academic, and faculty salary side of it. Neil Cafferty would handle the ancillaries, the business side of things, the mm-hmm. dormitories. And we worked together, and eventually Ruben Lorenz, who became vice president, I worked a lot with. So I kind of evolved into a budget and academic program person.
Who did you work most closely with then?
Clodius.
Yeah,
Clodius. And I was in his office right up to the time of merger and afterwards. So,
okay.
And my title changed along the way from assistant vice president to associate vice president to vice president for academic programs and budget, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Clodius was the vice president of the university and number two. He and Fred had a professional relationship, but they were not close personally, and they were nice compliments to one another in terms of their style and their approach. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from both of them.
Yeah. Well, we may as well move on to 1971 then.
Okay.
I guess at the beginning of the year we have the appointment of Weaver mm-hmm. following Harrington's demise. And incidentally, could you comment on that, on Harrington's resignation and whether or not it was an inevitable thing or a good thing?
I can't make a value judgment about it. I can offer you my opinion, which is that I think he saw the handwriting on the wall in terms of things happening, and I think he just got tired of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And you do get tired of doing that. It's a heck of a pace for a long period of time. And I think he was genuinely attracted back to academic interests. Mm-hmm. I think he'd been to the mountain and enjoyed it as much as he wanted, and went back to a different kind of mountain. So my recall of the details at that time were not, that great, but I think it was getting increasingly problematic dealing with the board, regents, right, et cetera, for him. And if I were to review my notes, I'm sure, or my newspaper clippings from the time, I'm sure I could be a lot more explicit for you. But okay. I think it was a personal decision and a desire to change back to something he enjoyed more.
Well, let's talk about Weaver then. Okay. Were you involved in his selection?
No. We were kind of there on the, you know, on the sidelines. The Regent Search and Screen Committee function. This is the first time I've been around for the selection of a president.
Right.
So I can't give you any historical perspective on that. I remember they took up the responsibility, moved ahead. I believe by that time Republican appointees were in the majority on the board. And I believe Bernard Ziegler and a few others were the ones that were instrumental at the time.
Let me just put this over.
Well, anyhow, we were discussing the process of selecting Weaver. I was not directly involved. I was not staffed to the committee. There were candidates, inside candidates. Bob Clodius had been acting president, and clearly he would have liked to have been president. I think the board made the decision to go outside, and it was at a time when the student movement and uprisings were particularly noticeable, and I think if you think of it in terms of Republican board, it might have tended to be harder on that and thus on themselves and their expectations. So it's clear they were looking for someone who, aside from all the other skills that one has to have to be an academic leader, at least had some feelings that things had gotten out of hand with the students, and or at least a track record of being able to deal with a firm hand with that. And John Weaver came across to them that way. I don't know how many people they had on their final list. I don't know where John Weaver was on that list. All I know is that he appeared as the finalist, and the only discussions I recall at the time were, A, that he came from Madison and very much wanted to come back. His father had been here, grew up here, was a professor here. Two, that at Missouri he had had to deal with students in recent months and had some record for doing that forcefully, or at least having a style that attracted the regents to him, not to mention whatever other credentials he brought. I mean, he had the credentials of being a geographer, Phi Beta Kappa, you name it, he'd done those things, and he had certainly had experience with a university that had more than one campus, because Missouri had an additional campus or two at the time. So he came in. I don't remember much about the process other than they had selected him. Bob Clodius and I worked hard preparing the materials for his transition in, you know, and I did get involved in that, backgrounding him in this, preparing briefing booklets. I was involved in that part of the process after he was selected. I was not involved in the selection.
Was that, what I should ask now is that soon after, almost immediately after he was appointed, Lucy came out and announced that he was going to put merger.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Okay. Lucy announced, urged the Board of Regents not to pick a president before the merger idea that had been surfaced for reasons we can get into later had been had reached fruition, that you would be bringing in a person, and that person might not be acceptable to the governor as the head of a new merged system. And my recollection is dim, but I certainly remember that part of it, and there was this joying back and forth, and these were Knowles appointees out on that board, and Lucy's now become governor. Elected to that governorship, as many previous Democrats were, with the active support of the faculty of the Madison campus, who found the identity with him that they might not have found with Knowles, although Knowles, probably in retrospect, financially was very good to higher education. He was known as the education governor for a while. And while there may have been nuances of education he did not, you know, cotton to or understand, he had a faith in it, and he would support it, and I thought was fair with us most of the time, you know, when we came up in the budget before the governor. But anyhow, Pat Lucy was elected, and among his position papers or policy papers or among the late emerging documents was the merger idea got floated. Now, instrumental in that was David Adamany, who had been a professor of political science in the Madison campus, and is really fingered as the person who was the inside, what we call it now, the deep throat on merger. In other words, he was the one who advanced the idea.
Personally to Lucy.
Personally. Not, I mean, Lucy, Pat Lucy was the kind of guy that he was a philosophy major from Marquette, successful businessman in real estate, always a power in the Democratic Party, and was part of one of the two or three people that really restructured and rejuvenated it. If you read the history, there incidentally is a brief history that was done by a student about Lucy and how he came from being a mild-mannered grocery clerk to governor of the state. But Pat Lucy was he was a little like Harrington in this way. He'd like to take a very unique idea and say, let's just do it. And when Adamany hit him with this, and there may have been others, but mainly I think it was David Adamany, he said, let's just do it, write something up. Mm-hmm. And so the paper evolved, and it was more of an idea on paper, and suddenly, it started to take on credence among people.
There are some who say that his input in terms of this paper or in terms of his idea for merger came more from the people that he brought, I forget the exact term that they used for the sort of a Harvard-educated his staff.
Well, there were people on his staff. There were the Bob Duns and others who would like this idea too and say, why not try it here? I think Adamany was the philosophical touchstone on it, that Bob Dunn and a couple others were the people who actually put the flesh and moved it along as the idea and developed. There had been, incidentally, through all of this, statewide commissions to improve the efficiency of higher education, the Kellogg Commission 1, the Kellogg Commission 2. They're all part of that prologue to merger, incidentally, and I met with the Kellogg Commission, and we worked a lot with them on how they were going to make us more efficient business-wise. A lot of businessmen. It was the Blue Ribbon Committee solution, and Kellogg was a whirling dervish, and somewhere during the debate about this time, he and I both appeared before a joint meeting of the Senate and the Assembly Education Committees.
Is this in Knowles? Governorship, or is this?
I think this is after. This is when merger's been surfaced. My chronology here may be wrong.
Yeah.
But I think merger idea had surfaced, and therefore, I'm trying to think who he was from Marshfield. Republican from Marshfield was chairperson of the assembly of one of the education committees. Put together a joint education committee. I'll think of his name in a little bit. They had a joint hearing, and they invited people to come in and comment on higher education coordination, merger, post-secondary education commissions, as I recall, Kellett committee. Well, Kellett and I were among the people testifying. And I was asked, I was clearly there as a representative of the university, but I was asked, from an academic perspective and a management perspective, what I thought about it. And I remember saying something like, anything that reduces three bureaucracies to one can't be all bad. I can't remember my exact words. I think you may have found it somewhere, but that's where Matt Palmer, the Cap Times, started following my career. And it's after the CCHE, he followed it through there, and then he followed it, and always has managed to dredge up all the flip things I said in life. But, and done so, you know, not in a way that vicious. But in any case, they were surprised, that someone from the university had said that. No one dressed me down for saying it when I returned home. Indeed, I think the university had credibility by admitting what everyone else knew to be true, that what we were dealing with was a historical artifact here, the way things developed. That doesn't mean they had to always be that way. So that kind of went on. I digress. We were talking about Weaver's arrival and Lucy and wanting them to hold off appointing. Well, the board went ahead and appointed Weaver. In any case, we can move from there if that suits you.
So your immediate reaction was pro-merger. Was there any other than the...
I was not anti-merger, is the best way to say it. I had an open mind. I said there are a number of things. I said, you're going to have to deal with the issues of campus autonomy. No one listened to what I said after the opening flip remark about one game. But I had just written down on a card, sitting there. Mm-hmm. Here were the issues that had to be dealt with. I got that card out, probably 10 years later, and it had 7 of the 10 items that the Merger Implementation Study Committee had on it. That's mm-hmm. what would have to be done. So it was just kind of agenda setting on an if-then basis, what you'd have to do.
Mm-hmm. In her chapter in a history of the university, Clara Penniman remarks that although you early supported the wisdom of merger, there were times when you attempted to remain out of the picture. Do you have any reaction to that? I didn't quite know what to make of that.
Mm-hmm. There was a time when merger was hot and heavy in the legislature,
mm-hmm.
and I think by that time I was the executive vice president of the university, I'm not sure. But doesn't matter, I was from the university as a part of Weaver's staff. Mm-hmm. And I was the person who would go down to the legislature and talk with the various parties. Somebody characterized me as the stalking horse or whatever. But I did. I could talk with most of the people down there. I think I had a reputation of being honest, of having some knowledge of what was going on, and at least a modicum of competence and candor, and therefore people would talk to me from both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
And so the deal was, when we were sure it was going to go, if I was out of the picture, it was when it was still iffy, you know, and we simply agreed there could only be one spokesman for the university, and that had to be the president of the board president. And I was not silenced. Clara's observation is probably correct. I was not as obvious, but I was working a lot behind the scenes during those periods. So I sort of dropped out. And people like to seize upon my initial statement as being pro-merger. I was not against the idea.
Mm.
That's different from being pro. I said, let it prove itself. Let's see what its merits are. Let's see what the advantages
that
are.
Seems is that a sort of was a sort of popular response in town.
It eventually I thought was kind of the. It was not a coming down squarely in the middle of both issues. It was kind of, well, let's examine it and see
mm-hmm.
how it plays out, and let's make sure before we do it that it'll have the results that we intend and won't have some unintended results which could impair universities or
mm-hmm.
higher education.
Was there? Did you feel from any direction a strong anti-merger response?
To be honest, the place you would expect that would be from the faculty of the UW at Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine their consternation, Clara Penniman among them, that their gubernatorial candidate, the one they had worked for, suddenly hit him with this. And I remember him coming to a faculty meeting of the faculty senate, which was packed, and defending his choice,
yeah,
and being attacked from the floor by Anatole Beck and all the usual people who would attack you. One or two professors getting up and saying, well, we'd like to see it be given a first. And Lucy, in effect, saying, I really don't care what you think. This is what's got to happen for the good of the state, because
mm-hmm.
you haven't been able to manage your affairs effectively. Now, the record of that meeting, even the tape of that meeting, is available.
Yeah.
And he was just that blunt. I mean, just that blunt. That was his second trip out there. He was also out there at a meeting down in the UW Center somewhat earlier.
In March, I think.
And, same subject.
Mm-hmm.
So there were two appearances. One was before a broader faculty body. I think it may have been of the UW multi-campus faculty body in the center, kind of a representative body we had formed. And then the other was the Madison campus. But they were, in effect, hoisted on their own political petard. How could they be against him? And quietly, they would go tell him, there were people who went to him and said, you've got to be out of your head. You'll destroy the Madison campus if you do. Or you can't take the aura of the Madison campus and cast it to Superior or to Eau Claire. You know, I know of people who made that appearance to him. He just discounted it totally.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't listening at that stage. And they really honestly didn't care. They would like not to have opposition, but they felt they had the cards.
Yeah.
They obviously did.
Okay. Well, you know, I can understand that mm-hmm. response by the faculty being mixed because there yeah. was a lot of support for him yeah. there. But what about the Board of Regents, a dominantly Republican?
Yeah.
They seem to have the same sort of lukewarm.
They did, but now imagine that he was singing out of the Republican hymn book, more effective management, more effective control, control the graduate. He was quoting back some of their own rhetoric at them, so they were neutralized. So you neutralize the Madison faculty, you neutralize a Board of Regents, with the exception of an Arthur de Bartleben, who could never be neutralized by anyone, except himself, perhaps. There was kind of a, you know.
Could you explain that further, your comment on de Bartleben?
Oh, de Bartleben he's an original first edition person, champion of the Madison campus, champion of faculty rights, faculty governance, you know, etc. And he wasn't afraid to speak out against anybody. Mm-hmm. And he did not think much of the merger idea and went places to say so. He's the exception, though. There was no one else on the Board of Regents saying that at that time. Mm. And that's what I mean. And because he was such a strong and a convincing spokesman, the faculty were able to identify with him when they couldn't identify with Lucy. So their views got expressed through Arthur, who was a formidable person and a fine intellect and just an absolutely interesting person to work with. Sometimes, when I said, sometimes he was his own worst enemy, because his defense or his statements, he would sometimes take them to the point where he would offend his colleagues. But he felt that he was right, and on many issues. And on many issues, I must say, he was right in principle, and we certainly need people to speak up for principle mm-hmm. now and then. But he was good at that. Mm. But the other people were kind of neutralized.
Yeah. And Weaver neutralized by his sort of christening?
By his christening and his board and coming in yeah. and...
There is in your records, there mm-hmm. is a letter from him to you where he says that he's not really restricted by Lucy's appointing him, but yeah. But you, Don, know my restrictions.
Yeah, and yeah. Like, well,
he's referring to the board there?
I was trying to recall that letter. I think he's saying that his restriction is that if he speaks up too much, he'll lose it all. Because
yeah.
he was the odds-on candidate to be the head of the system.
Yeah.
In fact, Lucy said so at some point in
right.
time.
That's what I meant to say by his christening.
Yeah, his christening, yeah.
Anointment.
And therefore, by doing that, it was a masterstroke by Lucy. He effectively neutralized. He would neutralize anybody in that position who wanted to stay mm-hmm. as head of the university that he came back to serve. And that was John. John had very strong feelings about that. Mm-hmm.
So the Board of Regents, chooses to take a non-combative
yes.
response.
And there was a belief, the political realists on that board, like Odie Fish,
mm-hmm.
felt it was going to happen. And therefore, the strategy was get in the best position you can to protect the interests of your entity, namely the University of Wisconsin. Vis-a-vis WSU, the state university system, working to protect its yeah. interests. And so there were all sorts of things that happened. The presidents of the WSU campuses, they had an association of presidents that would meet. And while McPhee would not speak up, he would speak through them. So they would rant and rave, you know. So they were pretty noisy about this. Yeah. Whereas the chancellors on the UW side of things were not that noisy, as I recall. You know, they were trying to get on the business of higher education, but those same group of presidents of WSU eventually became chancellors, had a list of 10 demands of merger. I can't even remember them all. You know, they were kind of the stalking horse for Gene mm-hmm. McPhee, mm-hmm. and it was interesting.
No one was really taking this anti-merger stance. Everyone had their own thing yeah. to gain from it. And
yeah, or... they said, you know, it's kind of, if it's inevitable, make the most of it.
Yeah.
And therefore, yeah. It was a master strategy by the governor.
Mm-hmm.
He effectively neutralized people to the point where the idea appeared to then have support and to be going, which forced people beyond neutralization to feathering their own particular nest in terms of protecting their own interests.
Okay, so in trying to work out, I'm going from what was in your records
okay.
here now.
All right.
There's a lot of literature back and forth from the central policy group is the term that
right.
is on top of the letters,
right.
and I'm curious as to who is included in that group. Mm-hmm. It's communication between the Board of Regents and the central. Is it yourself and Mr. Weaver?
Mm-hmm.
Any others?
Clodius maybe at that time. Can't remember. It was an entity of administrators. In any case, Smith maybe. I can't remember at that time. My chronology is wrong, but central policy group was kind of the body that could do what the presidents of the state university could do with an identity, anonymity, but identity, you know, as speaking from the highest level. So.
Was the chancellor, Ed Young, involved directly with you, or was he acting independently of yourself?
The answer to both questions is yes.
Yeah.
Ed Young was he was as good as a politician as Lucy was as a politician, and Ed was good in an academic environment. And there was the question of did Ed Young want to be head of the new system, as I recall, et cetera. He eventually became head of it, but I don't remember all the details there. They're really kind of hazy for me at this stage.
Okay.
The Central Policy Group, though, was a body we created in the central administration as a management and consultative mechanism for the president, and it really his staff to carry out things, as I recall. I'd have to refresh my memory on it. I almost forgotten about it.
So the in 1971, I'm thinking that your problems as Madison representatives
yes.
of the administration were not so much with Lucy as with keeping as much of the Madison funds as you could.
That's right, and clearly through all of this, I can remember many, many times John Weaver saying, as important as Green Bay and Parkside and the center systems are in their own right, they are not, and UW-Milwaukee, nothing is more important than protecting the flagship, the jewel of this crown. He loved those phrases.
Yeah.
And it was always his goal. Now, he was not the head of that campus. Ed Young was. And the chemistry between Ed Young and John Weaver was not a good chemistry. I mean, they were just not the other's kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I can say about it. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they were probably unduly suspicious of one another, even though they both had the best interests of the Madison campus at heart, you know. It was just how that would be done, and there were issues of pecking order and protocol that at some time seemed to take precedent over more substantive matters. But that was on the level of a personal relationship between them, which I, for one, simply tried to work around.
Yeah.
It was a given that that wasn't ever going to quite work.
What about the chemistry between yourself and Weaver?
And Weaver, I thought we were pretty compatible. For some reason, he wanted me to be the executive vice president, and I said I would do that the same way I was an assistant. And so if I could be my own person, that doesn't mean I just want chance to make recommendations. If I lose, I lose, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed working with the board. So I think I can remember no instance when he got totally upset with me, and he was constantly accessible to me. Whereas the traffic between Harrington and Clodius in those two offices may have been infrequent, ours was frequent. We were friends as well as professional associates.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed him and his family, and it was a marvelous opportunity for me to try to serve and make a useful contribution. He gave it to me, so I'm indebted for that, obviously. We were complementary of one another in the sense of he had skills I would never have, and I had some that were not part of his, you know, armamentarium. So I think we were a pretty good complement, particularly when we got Don Smith in there. I think we were a pretty good team of three, you know, in terms of. But, I mean, John Weaver was his own kind of person, just like Fred Harrington was.
Yeah.
And we are what we are.
Well, I want you to get to talk about some of the other things around the state coming at you. There are some letters in the or some discussion in your file about responding to efforts that Dreyfus had made. And it's, I'd like to get you to talk about that.
Among the state university presidents, Dreyfus was particularly supportive of merger and came out for it right away.
Mm-hmm.
And was trying to, in the views of some people at the university, be a kingmaker, be a power broker in all of this, and to offer to be a willing tool of the governor in leading his brethren into the merger fold. And he was good at it. Mm-hmm. Lee is forever a bright and able opportunist. I worked for him later on, so I know. Mm-hmm. And he picked me to work with him there. He was a chancellor in the system I was the vice president of, you know, and so I dealt with him from both directions organizationally. But at that time, it had more or less focused on Lee as the principal spokesman for the WSU system presidents. And I don't remember all the details, but we spent a lot of time trying to counter things he was doing.
Yeah.
You know, just as you would. Remember now, we're maneuvering there for position, if and when, and even after merger came. There was still a lot of maneuvering that went on in the first few months.
Yeah, any recollection of the issues there? Or?
I don't remember, quite honestly. Yeah.
Well, you were advisor in that year and the year that followed to the merger implementation study committee.
Yes.
Were you an active participant there?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Gene McPhee was the other advisor, as I recall, from the state university side. I was the advisor from the university side. And there were regents from both, you know, and there were representatives, there were legislators, there were public members. And if you've had a chance to read the record, you know its charge was to, you know, take care of some of the fine details now that the great idea has passed. And it was at one and the same time a forum for all the debates that are going on now about distinctions between the campuses.
Yeah.
It was a forum for debating whether Madison practices standards or the Madison way of doing things was going to be imposed on everyone else. Parenthetically, Pat Lucy's greatest joy was near the end of the battle over the merger. He'd gone up to UW University, or State University at Superior, and the students there presented him with calendars they had printed that said UW Superior. This was before the merger. He thought that was great. He'd just come back and hooted, you know. He said, the students want it. And I said, publicly, I said, there were people who were saying, well, during merger implementation, we can always go back. I said, the minute a diploma has UW-anything on it, University of Wisconsin, it'll never go back. Never.
Yeah.
And the realities are it won't. You know, they will have UW in their name. You can never take it away because you have then a diploma from the University of Wisconsin dash. And dash Madison was very hard for people to say, incidentally. They wanted to be the University of Wisconsin. There was great
still
debate.
Very hard.
The hyphenated, there was debates over whether it was one hyphen or two, whether, you know, or paren Madison, or, I mean, why couldn't we be, you know, this and that. And it's still very hard, and there was great offense during the early months of merger, because I'm the one that had to really orchestrate how merger was going to work from a budgetary, organizational, and just general relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And not Don Smith had an important role in this too, but I ended up with the bulk of the real nuts and bolts work for it. And so I organized things. I, you know, was it going to be UW Stout or UW Menominee? All those issues we were all involved in. And I tried to be sensitive to all those things, deal with campus autonomy. It was really, and we were expected to perform right from the start. CCHE had failed, by God. You know, you get it settled. And you know, it was the question of, I remember inviting the staff from WSU over to UW for the first meeting, a joint luncheon. It was Tent City.
Mm-hmm.
And McPhee had stepped aside, and they quickly rushed Len Haas down from Eau Claire, where he never wanted to leave, and then over into the slot, you know, of the number two person, because that's just the way the realities were. And for a short period of time, lesser lights like me, I was vice president for the chapter 36, the old UW, and Bob Winter was vice president for chapter 37, old WSU. That finally dissipated. But in any case, there were so many things that went on that, I mean, and it came so fast. I think it was a marvel of adaptation, and I think the fact that after 1 year, we had a common budget system. CCHE couldn't accomplish that except in a paper sense. You know, we really had we had a common management information system in 18 months. It was a marvel. It was a testimony of the people that really pulled it off. The Merger Implementation Committee, first of all, met in different locations for a while, symbolically, and finally started meeting fairly regularly to get its work done. And I haven't even reviewed its charge. I didn't do any of that preparation for this that I should have done. But in essence, they may have had 8 tasks to do. And Jack Pelosek was the regent from the UW who was involved and influential, very good former legislator, attorney. And he had a significant role. He was chairperson, as I recall of it. He and I had a good relationship. I did a lot of the staff work for the, I was a consultant, but I saw that they got what they wanted. I was able to participate actively. I was asked my views. I was there for all the meetings and helped fashion the final report.
Was it a very factional group?
Oh, it couldn't help but be that early. It was like the first one. I had to make the arrangements to convene the first meeting of the joint boards of regents. You know, we had to find a room big enough, and we had to worry about how everybody's going to sit, and would Polk sit next to Ziegler, you know. All those, I felt like the State Department. But similar things on merger implementation. You wanted to know, how are those legislators who were involved going to line up one way or another? Mm-hmm. And there were some good ones. And then there were some people who were kind of in left field most of the time and had their own axe to grind, wanted to protect this or that interest. But the factionalism was topical. It depended on the topic. For the bulk of the things, they got down to it. But when it came down to faculty interest, Clara was in there, mm-hmm. you know, pitching for her interest, and John Levine was in there pitching for the interest of the state university and the governor. Levine was the regent who felt he was the governor's handmaiden, anointed. I'm not sure the governor felt that way, just like Dreyfus was among the presidents of the WSU. But it was, I thought it was a pretty good exercise, and I've been through a lot of exercises like this, and it was productive in the long run, and it was kind of the ritual dance necessary soon after merger. You know, it was the place to which you could refer matters that you couldn't handle somewhere else. And I hadn't even reread the report, or I'd be much more conversant with it for you today, but I do have it, and, you know, it was an interesting time.
But not... No strong effect on the legislature in the
Oh, world. I think what we did was educate legislative leaders who were on the committee so they could be key in the debates mm-hmm. and any discussions. And I think it was a good educational process. A lot of old thing. I mean, the faculty representatives, the organized, the TOF or whatever it was called at the time would use it. They'd have... There was a lot of that factionalism. There's more factionalism among faculty over faculty interests than there were over the broader interests of merging the university system.
Okay.
And that's where the factionalism was. Plus a little regionalism, protecting. There had been in the state university system kind of the local viceroy regent, so that there were regents just by sheer coincidence, I'm sure, came from the towns where they came. And some presidents would clear all their appointments. They'd feel they had to talk with their regent every day.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to eliminate that immediately with merger. We knew it came in. We didn't have that on the UW side, but we saw it coming in. It was a great fear that Weaver had and I had, and we worked hard to make them be citizens. They had no tradition. They had no joint tradition, which was the hardest thing for that Board of Regents for 5 years. There was no joint tradition. Anytime they went in one or the other, there was always that little hair got up in their back. But we tried hard to say, we don't want the viceroy regents. We had another term at the time, but they were the, you know, the local regent. And now there were people in Merger Implementation Study Committee who had local interests at heart. And Dreyfus would appear and present the demands of the 10 state university presidents, or 11 at the time. Mm-hmm. I remember him appearing and making some noise once or twice. But other than that, it went along pretty well. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Students were on it, but hardly I worked hard to try to get them to speak up, but that's hard. I mean, to be caught up in that milieu is, geez. Mm. You know, just had no way to grasp everything that was going on.
Do you have any impressions now of the...
I'm just looking.
Any impressions now of the final bill? Was it, from Madison's perspective, was it as good a bill as could be gotten?
It was good as could be gotten. It was probably better in some respects. There was a lot of last-minute trade-offs that had to go on. And while I don't recall the exact details, I remember working very hard with certain legislators to assure that things got in there. And to protect, quite frankly, the interests of the Madison and of the UW system. See, and I had to think about the future too, and I knew we would have to end up working together, so I had to do it in a way that was sensitive to the people in the state university system, most of whom I knew in their central office. I had known them either personally or otherwise or professionally. So
what was interesting. What was the nature of the change then when you were part of a new structure with Weaver at the top?
Well, at first, you know, we had to go through the bureaucratic ritual dance was, if Weaver is number one, WSU person's number two. So I go from my number two office over to corner office, and Winter, the other number three, is over in another office, and the two business people are up here, and it's a question of, were we going to merge? They were over in a building on Gilman Street, and were we going to merge it? And I said, yes, we're going to merge it, and made a strong case for doing that. And I worked hard on things like that. We put the state university system had a much bigger central component for processing things than we had, so we put them out in Monroe Street. They liked being out there, and we put facilities out there because we couldn't get them all in Van Nuys.
Yeah,
and we were squeezing, but we couldn't get them all. And some people fell by the wayside as this went along, but there was a lot of courting and massaging and just a great deal of finesse needed to pull this off. Mm. And I remember being in the middle of it most of the time and trying to use each occasion for compromise as an occasion for proving that we could do some things together better than we did them separately. And how could we? I remember saying, what I'd like to do is make sure we take the best of both systems and then make it ecumenical. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of preached that as much as I could. Mm-hmm. You know.
A lot of comments have been given about the success of your sort of, is it a trio or a duo with yourself and Smith and Weaver? What was the secret there?
Well, the secret was that John Weaver let the two of us administer our respective responsibilities. We would dutifully clear them. He would add his insights, put his imprimatur on them, give a direction now and then. But for the most part, he delegated effectively. And we were two people that could function best in that way. And together, we were compatible personalities. Each had done what the other had done somewhere previously. He had been an academic or an administrative vice president. I had been an academic, you know, this sort of thing. And I liked him instantly. I enjoyed him thoroughly. And the two of us, the two Dons, as we were referred to, you know, and people would confuse us, and we'd just love it. They'd come to me and thinking I was Smith and say, I'd know you anywhere, you know. And they didn't know us at all, you know. Sometimes we put different name tags on one another. We kept among everything else a sense of humor between the two of us. We both didn't take ourselves, we took our job seriously, but we never took ourselves too seriously. Mm-hmm. John occasionally took himself quite seriously. But he simply let us operate. And the Board of Regents came to, we took places at the table on either side of the president. We would handle the bulk of the business at the meeting with the president doing what's the appropriate things, but he would defer to us. We would staff the two committees. I would do one or the other, or I would float, and Don would do academic affairs, and I'd have Reuben Lorenz would do, and Winter would do business or facilities. I floated more than Don. Don was almost always in education. But we spent time getting to know the campuses we didn't know, promoting, you know, just tried to have some standards and values, and tried not to, you just couldn't be, you never pretended and you never tried to fool anyone. You simply said the way you thought it was, and people were looking for directions, and I think they got them. you know, and they seemed responsive. The chancellors, we got them working together. That was, talk about the Board of Regents getting the chancellors and then the faculty groups. I mean, that was the real challenge. That's where the factionalism existed the most, not among the chancellors. They had theirs, but it's among the faculty groups, and it was always the Association of State University Faculty as a block.
Yeah.
You know, it was important. Except you could every once in a while peel away one on an issue, but as a result, I don't think early on the faculty group that we had was effective, and you could never be totally open with them. You got to the point where you could be totally open with the chancellors, and by being that made them totally open, and we became team. And I don't think it was until we started making some changes of chancellors that the system matured. Chancellors who should have retired. Chancellors who should have gone and done something else did something else. And that took a certain amount of finesse on all parts and a certain amount of diplomacy and skill. Don was particularly good at this, Don Smith. Mm-hmm. And he always had an angstrom more patience than I had. The nice thing about it is either one of us could go away and not worry about the place because the other knew what to do.
Yeah.
And I think we were seen as people who were people of our word, and also that we could deliver. We had enough good people around us to compliment us that we could deliver a good product that people began taking pride in and said, hey, maybe this thing can work. If it's going to be here, we'll just soon have these two guys doing it to someone else.
Did you feel pressure in those years, 73 to 75, say, to put out a budget or hammer out a budget that would save money?
No. Other than the pressure I had on myself normally.
Yeah.
I really didn't behave any differently then than I behaved prior to merger in terms of how I managed things, you know, the things that were mine to manage. Mm. It was a little bit harder, and the decisions were not easier because you had more people to upset with your decisions. But I remember we had a process. We invented this idea of decision item narratives, and they would each put it together, and it would come up, and I said, I'm going to send all of your requests, and the board can see them, even the ones we've turned down. Mm-hmm. And I said, you make your best case because they're going to read them. And I remember the DIN booklets going to the board. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were about that thick. In the front were the one-third that we supported, in the back were the two-thirds that we didn't. And I would, every time I made a presentation, I said, I want to call your attention to the fact that we did not support three DINs from the Whitewater campus. They dealt with this. The chancellor wishes to speak to those he can. Very seldom, the chancellors felt they had been dealt with fairly. Mm-hmm. And I remember a lot of sessions on the budgets. And I shouldn't speak for them. If you interview them, you'll find out how they felt they were dealt with. But as a result, I was absolutely surprised when we got to the Regents, had very little rancor. Again, it was often over the salaries and the TALF versus the other people, over, just like it is now. Mm-hmm. That never changes. They wanting dollar equivalency. If they can have the same salaries, they wanted the same dollar increases on their salaries that the percentage increase gave the Madison. That we never quite resolved. Don't think anybody will ever resolve it. It's just one of those things that you live with in a state of flux. But we did get a comment. We got something that had an integrity to it. I would develop budget themes. They would get on board with the themes. We presented the budget in terms of themes. Mm-hmm. Later on in my life, I called them initiatives, you know, in other incarnations. But it was a way to bring people together around themes. And we were able to sell themes to the Regents, sell them to the governor, keep that integrity, and keep a block of cohesive chancellors behind them.
The reason I asked about the pressure was that one of the big selling points for Lucy and the supporters of merger that was that it was cost of
It would save money. I
recall a letter that you sent to assembly member, I think Swan, documenting savings.
We were often asked that. And I did prepare that. But that wasn't my marching order, and I never had pressure from the governor's office to do that. I had no pressure from the governor. I got along fine with the governor.
Yeah.
I think that he and the president never quite, chemistry was not good there. Chemistry was better between Lucy and Ed Young than it was between Lucy and Weaver. That would bother Weaver for both reasons. But and I can understand that. John was a sensitive person. We all want to be liked, but they just never cottoned to one another. So, but Weaver bless him, I mean, he would let Smith and I do the work, you know, including in the governor's office, and that's the way it got done. Mm. Tony Earle was down there in a particular role, as I recall, DOA or something. I can't remember all the details of that now. You see all the same actors and actresses around now.
Yeah. Are you in support of the... Are we running out of time?
About 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, let me just finish up this.
Okay.
Are you still as supportive of merger as
you
were?
You know,
did it save the state money?
Well, you can only say what would have happened if it hadn't
been
merged. Some other solution would have been invoked, post-secondary commission. It saved money in terms of, I think we were able to reduce program duplication, to focus the missions of the campuses so they didn't try to, I mean, we were going to have doctoral programs on all the state university campuses.
Mm-hmm.
And for every time you gave one, you had to give another. We knocked that stuff off. Right at the beginning, we says, here's your core mission, here's your special mission, build towards excellence. People saw that as a move towards efficiency. So relative to what would have been, it sure did save money.
Okay.
It also conserved and focused resources more effectively and made for much stronger programs. I would have had to have 6 strong programs than 10 mediocre ones. And that's what we worked on.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the real tough decisions to make.
Mm-hmm.
Those were not always popular decisions, but I always got the impression that they were respected decisions, even by the people whose lives were affected by them. That's not to say we didn't have our detractors.
Mm-hmm.
People think we've made absolute wrong judgments, and we may have in some instances. No one's perfect.
Mm.
But I think that merger was inevitable. I was glad to be there to try to make it work, and I felt that as a public servant, it was my job once it was the law to make it work, and that's what I told everybody. I forgot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Smith and I worked hard not to be tagged as a Madison person or a Milwaukee person or as a UW person. You would have found it hard, other than that's where we came from, to find people who say that to our grave we were always deep in our hearts this, you know, or that. I respected the excellence of the Madison campus and worked to preserve that as best I could. And I just had a different agenda sometimes for that than other people.
Yeah.
But that was not my sole responsibility. So, it's kind of where we are.
Okay.
We're going to have follow-up if you want to.
Yeah,
any others,
I would like to.
Because I've got a group upstairs I'm going to meet.